Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Dr. Zid Haddad, a professor of instruction within the Department of Interdisciplinary Learning and Teaching at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I teach undergraduate and graduate courses in curriculum and instruction. In short, I teach teachers how to teach and save lives through the use of critical multicultural education as an approach to teaching and learning. Our podcast is produced by a different group of graduate students each week, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they're reading in my class, what they experience in the field, and how that impacts their own lives and understandings. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast from wherever you're listening. Also, you can ask us questions and engage with us further using the anchor.fm website or the anchor.fm app on your phone. You can submit questions and you can also send us voice messages. And remember, please share our podcast on all your socials so that we can build our audience. Thanks for listening, and here's today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Transformative Talk. My name is Austin. I'm a part-time graduate student at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and I also teach geometry at Idea Public Schools.
This is Estelle. I'm a full-time graduate student at UTSA. I'm a mom of five and a former Chicago Public School teacher.
Hi, everyone. My name is Loratu Ba, and I'm a current graduate student at the Behavior Analysis Department here at UTSA.
In this episode, we're going to talk about our experiences with critical multicultural education as children, what mindsets prevent critical multicultural education from being implemented, and how it relates to the COVID-19 learning loss. So, the main theme of our class with Dr. Haddad this semester is critical multicultural education. A good definition for it is an education that centers diverse experiences and empowers students to critique social norms that perpetuate hegemony, which is dominant culture, at the expense of others. So the first question that I have for the group is, what experiences have we had with CME as children? And then if we haven't, I guess we can talk about, like, what do you wish you would have seen in school?
So I have attended many different schools, a Catholic school, a public magnet school, and a very prestigious private school. And I have to say that my most impactful experience with critical multicultural education came during my time from 7th to 12th grade at North Shore Country Day School, which is in a pretty affluent suburb of Chicago. I attended from 1987 to 1992. And during that time, I got an in-depth exposure to the AIDS epidemic, homelessness in Chicago, the inner workings of lobbyists in DC, archaeological studies in partnership with Native Americans in the Mesa Verde area of Colorado, and some fairly uncommon takes on local and world history. While there, we were encouraged to challenge authority and confront structural and institutional inequalities with well-thought, action-oriented solutions. North Shore Country Day has shaped who I am and instilled in me a desire to live out their motto, live and serve. The school just reached their centennial milestone and continues to evolve and grow in its critical consciousness. They actually have a lower school protest studies department that encourages their junior kindergarten through fifth graders to look at issues such as race, gender, ability, the environment, and their own learning conditions to address inequalities or injustices. They have petitions, protests, walkouts, and demand change. It's really cute to see kids at such a young age exercising those kinds of rights. I could go on and on. The only thing about North Shore is the cost of tuition is crazy, but 20% of the students did receive financial aid and still do.
I love that. My experience is a little bit different because I came here as an immigrant, and for me, I had no idea that CME even existed or was even a thing. Like, I was just so busy trying to learn the new system to even notice that there was a gap within the system. And I feel like the older that I've gotten, I've started to gain a better understanding. And the main thing that I did notice when I was little was, like, when I was back in Africa, Kenya specifically, I noticed that, like, our history didn't, like, bridge the gap. Like, so we learned a lot of, like, oh, well, slaves coming to this. I mean, we know slaves coming to America, right? But we had no idea that, like, what happened to them when they got here. And then when we come here, we just learn about, like, when they come here and, like, what happened to them there. So there was no, like, learning of, like, what took place in between. But other than that, like, I had no idea or any sort of, like, cognition about what it meant to even learn about the system or what multiculturalism within the system was.
And then I think for me, I don't know if I have ever, like, had any experiences with critical multicultural education. I feel like my experiences in school were most are like, okay, February is Black History Month, and then, like, here are all the other different months that there are, and it's kind of like this tokenism, like, let's all feel good about each other's differences, as opposed to, like, really critically think about how we can, like, make sure, like, everyone's lives are improving and not just, like, cisgendered white men or, like, people with money and stuff like that. I think the first time I had an experience with that was in undergrad. I took a class called Sex, Power, and Politics, and we really, like, I don't know, it was a lot of fun. Like, we just really talked about, like, the different dynamics and how it plays out in politics. And also, I felt like a big component that class had that, like, my K through 12 education didn't have was, like, we also talked about, like, how we can change it and, like, just, like, how we can make it better instead of, like, let's learn about how, like, terrible the world is and just, like, period, that's it. So there's that. I think another question that I have for the group is, how does your desire for critical multicultural education impact the decisions you make as a parent or as an educator?
Sure. So I have 5 children, and I didn't realize how much critical multicultural education impacted me, because I didn't know that that was the right term for it. But I did know that what my children were getting in school was not okay with me. And so 2 years ago, I decided to pull one of my children from school and homeschool him so that I could kind of decide what curriculum to use and what kind of narratives he was going to get, which was amazing because I found resources like Rethinking Ethnic Studies and The Young People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. And it just taught him from a perspective that we weren't going to find in any other textbooks or that my other children didn't get in school. But being able to homeschool and have that kind of control over the curriculum it was amazing. And now it's something that is always on my mind, which is why I wanted to get this master's in curriculum and instruction so that I could be more aware of what is out there and what I should be teaching my not only my children, but students in the classroom when I go back into a classroom.
See, I feel like when you word it as like your desire for CME, I feel like there was no desire because I didn't know what it was. So in terms of like thinking about it as like as a parent, I didn't really think about it. I think I thought more, hey, let me make sure my kids are in a good school, in a good neighborhood. That's kind of how I thought about it. But like with taking this class and understanding those different and deeper perspectives, I think then now it's going to impact my decision making in terms of like where I'm going to put my kids in school and like do they offer this curriculum. So my kids live in Colorado, and I know CRT is approved there, I believe. And so I don't think that it's something that I have to necessarily worry about from that end, right? And on the other side, I feel like I've always felt that deep need to do the education myself. So I have these conversations with my kids. I sort of don't sit there like waiting for the system to take control of that. I feel like there has to be an aspect where like as parents or just not heavily relying on educators to do everything. Like, I feel like we need to jump in and sort of bridge that gap as well. So I think that's sort of my approach when it comes to like, how do I impart this type of knowledge when it comes to my kids?
That's so interesting, Laura, too, because I didn't think about like how the whole CRT drama would affect like how people are thinking about like people who like are in the know like us about CME would be like, okay, I know this state has laws that promote this, like promote or like do not promote this type of teaching or curriculum. So now I know like what I can look for in schools. And so I think my last question about this topic would be like, I originally wrote, what is CME something you consider when thinking about what schools you send your kids to? But I think I want to change the question to, like, what would you look for? Like, how would you know a school is doing CME or, like, has those types of things before you would, like, say, like, okay, I feel comfortable with my kids going there?
So my children are all in different schools, and it seems, I don't know if it's just the trendy thing to do or if schools are really trying to make this, tackle this the right way. But most schools now have like an equity and inclusion or diversity task force or some kind of a group at their school where it is parents and educators and the administration that is trying to work together. As simple as taking things like Columbus Day off their school calendar or calling it, you know, not celebrating cultural holidays in a superficial kind of way or tokenism kind of way. And I feel like many schools are trying to get that right. And so when I look at a school for my children, I am looking for those kinds of things, for those kinds of initiatives happening. And as a parent, I will question the leadership, the administration, if I see something either being taught or my child come home with some assignment that I think, oh, that's not right, or something about their school day or their calendar that, you know, I have a problem with. I have no problem taking it to administration now either.
I completely agree with, like, Estelle from that perspective of, like, hey, if it's not being taught, how do you sort of bridge that by speaking to, like, teachers or educators? The other way I sort of gauge that is, like, what kind of homework or assignments are they bringing home? So if I'm looking at, like, this picture of MLK that my kid is bringing home, then I feel like that opens up this, like, space for conversation. Okay, so you have a picture of MLK that you're supposed to color, but what are we doing with this picture? Who is this person? So I think that's how I sort of present that dialogue and based on her perspective or whatever knowledge she's acquired from school, then I'll know how deep they're going into it within the curriculum. So again, I sort of just like bridge that gap by also providing that extra like leverage for my kids when it comes to learning about how our system works and people who are maybe impactful within like our culture.
So during our class and with our classmates, we had a very fruitful conversation about the mindsets that prevent CME from being implemented in classrooms. And Michael Vavris in the text stated that there's a significant number of leadership and higher education positions who consider themselves colorblind and potentially neutral and therefore see race and racism issues as irrelevant. This thought process has led to a laundry list of resistance to implementing CME in the classroom. And it just seems common in, years ago in teacher preparation programs, but maybe it's changing, that teachers were kind of encouraged to try to be colorblind and stay neutral, and what that kind of mindset does with limiting critical multicultural education in the classroom. So what are your thoughts about that?
When I first saw the list, I think there were some portions of it on there that I have like done accidentally as a teacher. So one of them was like a fixation on like Eurocentric knowledge and like this is exactly the right way to do it. This is the only way to do it, blah, blah, whatever, whatever. And also like when I first started teaching, I had this like really, like I wanted my kids to go to college, which is like definitely a like a great thing to want your kids to do, but I wanted them to go to schools like University of Arkansas or like UT and stuff like that. And I think unintentionally I was telling my kids like going to like University of Arkansas at Monticello or like UCA or somewhere like that close by was still like not as good as going to like the state school, when in reality any college education is great. And like I feel like I was like accidentally and unintentionally diminishing that. And so the conversation that we had in class about this really a lot of people had some great things to say. So for example, Samantha said, I had so much resonation with this list. All these items are coded language that used that further studies deficit situates deficit thinking in education. All this serves to further white hegemony over educational spaces. All these things are problematic as they fail to recognize the racism inherent in these types of thinking. And then Gabriela said, working at a title on campus, a lot of teachers and leaders say, oh, pobrecito, have such a hard time at home, so they don't have high expectations for all students, which isn't equitable. And they like don't realize that students do come in with prior knowledge and just may be different with what we know based on their language and culture.
I think in just thinking about things that sort of like hinder the like decimation of CME within the classroom, I think a lot of it just centers around like this discomfort that like we all have, right? And I think it doesn't always just fall on like maybe the white teacher or the educator in this sense. I think everyone lives in this like environment where these conversations are so frowned upon and no one wants to say anything that's gonna be maybe offensive to other people. And I think we live in like a very, we tiptoe around this because we're living in such sensitive times where I don't know if I can say something and still get the grace of I can be corrected and use this as a learning opportunity. So everyone always thinks of it as, oh, I shouldn't even say anything because I get beat down when I say these things. So I think that also sort of hinders teachers from even having these honest conversations. Plus, there's also the influence of parents, right? So we don't know how parents are gonna feel about me as a teacher coming in and basically wanting to start a little revolution in my classroom. So how are parents gonna take this? How are they gonna perceive this? So I think it just, a lot of it centers around this discomfort of just having these conversations with kids.
Yes, I agree. And I see how that's happening in higher education too, because when you say something that may be controversial, it's not always backed up by, you know, people higher up or people that financially support that institution or their school board. And we saw how that was just happening recently in the news with Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Yeah, so Nicole Hannah-Jones is a journalist for the New York Times, and she embarked on this journey that aims to reframe American history by placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the United States national narrative, and named this work the 1619 Project. So she was offered the night chair position at the University of North Carolina, and she was offered a 5-year tenure track position. The problem with this was prior to her being offered this position, prior night chairs who happened to be white received the same position and it came with tenure. So she did not initially get tenure due to concerns of the university about her work with the 1619 Project, which, as I said earlier, was a collection of writings published by the New York Times Magazine that reexamines the legacy of slavery in America. So there was a lot of controversy surrounding, do we want to bring this sort of education or curriculum into the classroom for students who are starting to become journalists? So she got a lot of pushback on that. And this, it almost seemed like it stemmed from the white grant, the people who gave grants who happened to be white were feeling apprehensive because they called it the political nature of her work. So they didn't want to give the university any money or offer them any more grants because they didn't like what she was offering. And that's why there was a lot of pushback when it came to Nicole Hannah-Jones's work. So I just want to read like two comments from our classmates, right? And Miles comments and says, it was saddening but not surprising to see what happened at UNC. It's unfortunate that the university denied her tenure because the content in the 1619 Project is exactly what is needed, particularly in the southern states. Then I'll read the other comment, then I'm going to like bring my co-hosts. Given the 1619 Project has been prohibited from usage in the curriculum for social studies due to the CRT Senate bill, which is considered private curriculum or third-party curriculum, it'll be interesting to see how teachers combat this if they still use elements of the 1619 project in an adapted format, or if they will now be forced to develop something else to take its place. And Cesar from our class brought that up in class. And I thought his point was very interesting. And as prior educators, or current, Austin being a current educator, how would you go about this? Do you go, because I think this is a very sticky and slippery slope, almost like a catch-22. How do you combat saying, hey, I feel like my students should be learning about this, but the law literally states they cannot be talking about this within the classroom. So I'm going to hand this over to Estelle, and I want to hear what her thoughts are.
Sure. I have been thinking about this since it's come out in the news in Texas, and that's where we live. And so I feel like that's what is going to impact my children and then myself as a teacher. But I can't figure out how using primary sources would be against the law. So as a teacher, we just have to be creative. If we get a primary source, I know that, I taught in Chicago Public Schools, so in the Illinois standards, using primary sources was actually part of the standards. So I know it's not, Prentice Hill or McGraw or any of the other published, approved curriculum, but if we pull in primary sources, I feel like it will speak for itself. It's going to tell the truth if we go back to diaries of slave owners or newspaper articles or any other kind of primary source that doesn't have to be a published curriculum that is state approved, especially in the state of Texas. It can be done. I just feel like teachers and campuses will get creative in getting this material out there and slipping it in.
Yeah. Austin, what are your thoughts on bringing this sort of curriculum into the classroom?
I think personally, I, like, as a math teacher, I don't see a way of doing it. I don't know. But I think, like, over, like, beyond the 1619 project, people, like, don't, they're, like, they're thinking about critical race theory. I have air quotes. Like, I went to a wedding, a month or two ago, and, like, I was, like, the table I was at, like, they knew, like, me and all my friends were teachers, so, like, he just asked us randomly. This guy was like, so what do you think about critical race theory, or, like, teaching that? And I was like, what? And but, like, if he, like, I don't know if he, like, really understood that critical race theory is, like, is different than, like K through 12 teachers don't teach critical race theory. It is something that, like, the, like, Republicans hijacked and are using that phrase to instead talk about, like, oh, we don't like it when like bad things about white people in history are mentioned. And so it's like people don't know what they're talking about. So I say that to say, like, at my school, I'm the UIL academics coach for current events, and it's like a nerdy quiz competition about the news, which is very fascinating. And I feel like as I, like, recruit more kids, their parents are going to be like, well, what news sources are you looking at? And then, I'll, like, my ready-to-go, like, answer is, these are the approved list of news sources from UIL and the University of Texas. That's all I have to say.
Sometimes I wonder if it's just the wording, right? Because I think a lot of it is tucked in the language that we use, right? So I think when you're using a word as heavy, necessary, but as heavy as critical race theory, it already gets people's walls up. And I think when we're using such heavy terms, this might be a little controversial, but, like, I think it causes this divide, which CRT is not intending to do. So I always wonder, like, is it the wording that is, like, turning people off, or is it that people know what it is? Because I also think there's, like, an ignorance piece in there, right? We hear the term, but I think if you sort of, like, polled people and asked them, well, what is CRT? I think a lot of people don't have a deep understanding. Yeah, and I actually tuck myself into that, right? Prior to even reading any sort of literature on this, I was just kind of like, okay, I just kind of keep hearing this, right? And that's also embedded in our, we're coming from, we had no CME education growing up. So once we start hearing this, it becomes almost like a almost like a media buzzword clickbait type thing. And all we hear is they just want to teach about racism and anti-racism, and like that turns people off. And I always wonder, well, is it the wording, and maybe should we reframe that so that it's a little bit more palatable? But I also understand that, like, it's like time's up. There's no time to like make these things a little bit more digestible for people. But I also wonder if the end goal is to sort of have this sort of integration within the school system, maybe we could look into the wording.
I think CRT and CME do cause people discomfort, and you know, with those words like bring about some trouble, but it is necessary trouble. And so I don't think we need to change the word. We will be back after the break to discuss deficit thinking and how that has impacted the COVID epidemic.
Welcome back to this week's Transformative Talk. So for this portion, we're going to be talking about the COVID-19 learning loss, air quotes, and how it relates to deficit thinking.
So deficit thinking refers to the notion that students, particularly those of low income, racial, and ethnic minority backgrounds, fail in school because such students and their families have internal deficits that thwart the learning process, such as limited educability, lack of motivation, or inadequate family support. So we're all heading back to the classroom this fall after some students have been void of them or in them sparingly for the last 1.5 years. Many media outlets have come up with numbers and statistics to represent how many months have been so-called lost and dollars wasted in potential lifetime salaries and GDP without focusing on those things that have been gained during this time. This deficit thinking is prevalent in the education world as teachers and districts are planning to recuperate educational minutes with scripted, standards-based instruction. Our classmates talked about how this deficit thinking limits student outcomes and can be reframed in terms of a growth mindset. So Tess from class said that the tendency is to lean entirely on the notion of formal education being the legitimate and actually the most fruitful way to learn versus what you can learn in informal settings. That is one way to reframe this deficit thinking notion. So digital literacy and computer literacy is still learning. We should be talking to the community of parents and teachers to find out what the students have been doing behind the scenes of formal education while they have been at home. I see this comment from Tess, and I think what an opportunity to take advantage of the funds of knowledge that is so important in multicultural education. Imagine getting into the homes of the children through their experiences during this time and make meaningful cross-curricular lessons from that. In my own home, I like to view the COVID educational experience as an episode of John Krasinski's Some Good News. My four children, and I'm sure many others around the globe, did a whole lot of cooking, baking, and cleaning up after themselves and their siblings. We learned how to be creative with our groceries and meals, wasting less and sharing with our community more. There were puzzles, games, and conversations that we rarely had time for when typical school extracurricular activities and 3-hour daily commutes were happening. There was also a whole lot of time spent on electronics during the COVID period. And fortunately, I'm relying on the technical expertise of my children to help guide me through remote graduate school now. So I see this as a win-win. As a mom and an educator, what are your thoughts, Laratu and Austin, on the COVID-19 learning loss in relation to deficit thinking?
So I'm going to start off with like a quote from Nora in our class, and she got it from our reading, and it says, "Consequently, becoming aware of one's own deficit thinking and developing alternative ways of viewing the world is a difficult process. Human beings hide their deficit thinking from themselves in order to be able to perceive themselves as fair and equitable. In a society in which hegemonic rhetoric has promoted an egalitarian ideal." So I think from my perspective, I can't help but think of it from like a behavior analytic perspective, which is like, we always say like, if a child is learning in the clinic, we need to be able to generalize those skills into their natural environment. And I think there's no better example than COVID or like the pandemic to like put this into practice. So they've been in a classroom, they've learned all these things, but how do we bridge that by, I'm kind of like overusing the word bridge, but how do we bring that all together? And we always think about this concept of buy-in, right? A child is not gonna acquire these skills if the parents are not fully invested in their learning. So there's a big portion that we focus on, which basically says, hey, if I'm gonna work on these skills, I need you to work on them too. And I'm gonna train you on how to work on them too. So I guess it's not exactly the same, but I think we can draw parallels and say that, like, hey, we had the opportunity to be home with our kids, and yeah, that was difficult, you know, having to sit through a math class that, like, I don't know, second grade math is like not the second grade math that I took when I was little, so that was hard for me too. But it was a learning curve for both of us, for my child and for myself, right? And it comes with all these bumps in the road. However, I think they gained a lot more from just being at home and learning from everything that was happening. I mean, even just what was going on in terms of social justice in our country, that's a huge learning opportunity for our children that we can't just like toss to the wayside, right? And I think if parents took the time to even use that besides just doing math and science and, you know, language, I think just like bringing that into the learning space as well, we can't take that and see that as a loss in our education system. We can't be throwing out big numbers like, well, now these kids are going to be behind and they're going to lose income because of the year and a half of like in-person learning that they've missed out on. So I think changing our perspectives on like how we see learning and what formal and informal education can do when brought together is a big piece that like maybe we miss and don't think into in our society. I'm going to hand this over to Austin.
So as a teacher, I had my kids both like pre-pandemic and then like during the pandemic, because I taught like the 2019 school year, I taught them as eighth graders. And then for like the virtual pandemic school year, whatever, I looped up with them for geometry. So I had like a good way to see like how the pandemic and virtual school was like changing how they were as students. And it was very fascinating. So like, obviously, like, there were the stories of, like, the kids who were, like, ghosts, you know, like, wouldn't log into class, didn't do any work, like, whatever. And also, there were, like, really cool, like, individual moments of, like, a student who I had in eighth grade who, like, really struggled in algebra, like, wouldn't even try on the problems and just, like, really, like, could not see themselves as being successful in math. And then, like, during the virtual school year in geometry, like, they would get hundreds on everything. And, like, you could say, like, oh, like, maybe they were cheating or getting extra help, but I know they weren't. Like, they were not getting extra help. I believe they weren't. And so it makes me think about, like, I think we all alluded to this, like, we were all forced to, like, do something new and we got better at it, like, be it, like, technology and stuff like that. And so I think, like, as teachers, we were forced to change our practice, and the ways we changed it, I think, like, ended up being like a blessing in disguise. Like, now I know how to like record myself on my computer and like make a video of like my lesson, and so then like it could be saved on YouTube, and like if they're doing their homework or something, instead of like asking their parent or whoever, they can just like go watch me do it again and like pause where they want to and like go back and like get better at it. Or like everything's digital, so like if they were not really good at keeping track of like paper notes, it's all on their like program that they have on their computer from the school, and so they can easily go back and do it without having to think about like how to organize it. Like, it's just all on their computer. And so it was cool to see them get better at school. And I also like have some like sometimes I slip up and think like, oh my gosh, like the kids who I have next year, they're not going to be good at math because they weren't logged in. But I have to like stop myself from doing that, because that part makes me nervous for like starting again full in person in August. Who's next?
I think to just sort of piggyback on what Austin was saying, I think that this idea of like having our kids at home, as difficult and challenging as it was on both ends, we can't fail to acknowledge like teachers were struggling too, you know. I think our kids became a lot more technologically advanced, yeah, just because of this process. I mean, like within the first like 2-3 weeks of us doing distance learning, my kids understood that they needed to wake up at 8 and like log themselves in, and like if the teacher is saying go on YouTube for this video, like they knew exactly what to do. And granted, the kids that we have today are a lot more advanced than we ever were, but I think there was a lot of it's not just the curriculum is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. I think it was like there's a lot of learning beyond just the classroom for everyone. So I think we can't just like assume when they go back to the classroom, going back to this notion of deficit thinking, that, oh, because my kids come from this background, well, they're going to be behind and I have extra work to do, or I might be dismissive of them because of the extra work that I feel like I have to do because of this ideology that you've placed on they're not capable. There's a lot of learning that all of these kids from their different households could also bring together in the classroom and also sort of advance that learning, right? Like if a kid, I don't know, played video games for the entire time, because I'm sure those kids exist, there's something they learned there, right? If a kid's like spent the entire time just reading books, there's something they learned there. So if they can all bring that together, they can all sort of build from one another.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. There were definitely skills learned during this time that we probably need to rethink how we're going to value those skills that were learned and build off of those. So if you would like more information about this topic, you can visit the Asset-Based Community Development Institute at DePaul University. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you discovered our show. That's all for now, but I'll see you in the next episode of the Transformative Talk. Bye.
Bye. Bye.